This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. In the last 15 years, Cincinnatians have worked hard to create an entrepreneurial ecosystem to support innovation and entrepreneurs. That includes early stage financing and consulting through something like CincyTech, and later stage financing through Queen City Angels and other organizations. It also includes incubators like the Hamilton County Development Corporation and accelerators like the Brandery and UpTech. But the fate of any one company depends on a host of factors. A second and later stage funding, is it available at the right moment? Can a company attract the talent it needs when it's ready to grow? With funding and talent, can it scale up but not get swamped by swelling expectations while delivering high customer service? To discuss the state of startup environment in Cincinnati, we are joined by the CEO of Everything But the House, Scott Griffith, the general manager of the Brandery, Tony Alexander, and business reporter for Nine on Your Side, WCPO.com, Dan Monk. I do want to recognize that Everything But the House partners with Cincinnati Public Radio on funding efforts for our stations. If you would like to join the conversation, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you. Cincinnati Edition.
It's nice to have you here today. Dan, let's start out. A few weeks ago, you wrote an article citing some changes at Everything But the House, change in CEO, some layoffs there. And you also raised questions about some other startups that either had gone out of business or were scaling back, some that had been sold, et cetera, et cetera. And you raised the question about whether the startup scene in Cincinnati was really working right now. How do you feel about that? Do you feel negative about that? Do you think that we're not working?
I guess I'd answer your question with a question. Compared to what? I mean, compared to Cincinnati 10 years ago, we're a lot better off than we were. We're certainly better off because we have organizations like the Brandery and Centrifuge and Cincy Tech. So yes, we're a more vibrant scene here than we were 10 years ago, for sure. But if you compare us to Boston, San Francisco, Chicago, even Pittsburgh, we probably got some ground to catch up. Even Columbus and Indianapolis, I mean, they both made the cut for Amazon's second headquarters, largely because of their large and plentiful, talent in technology equipped.
And that talent question really is critical to all of this.
Yeah, right. I think that's true. And Tony, so that's why I think EBTH is such an important company to measure this, because it's one of the first companies that was not only successful at getting venture capital from outside the region, but it was also successful as a job creator. It went at its peak, it had 1,000 employees, and I think that's down to about 500 now. 600 employees locally, down to 300 now, and they have a plan for future growth. But this is an important company, kind of a bellwether for this segment of the economy.
Well, given what Dan just said, Scott, where does Everything But the House stand at the moment? I mean, there have been these changes. You've come in. There have been these cutbacks. What do you see as the future?
So thanks for having us on, and thanks for having me on to tell our story. There are a lot of changes at Everything But the House. We think all positive, and I'll tell you why. One, I joined the board about a year and a half ago, was sitting at a venture firm in Boston and learned of EBTH and took the first independent director seat after the last round of financing was completed. And I'm excited about the company today for the same exact reasons I took that board seat. The market potential of Everything But the House is billions of dollars, top line. The company got a little over its skis by opening too many cities too quickly. And that often happens at growth stage, where companies raise a big round of capital. They put a lot of investment into either geography or technology or big marketing push. And sometimes it works great and you just keep on going. Sometimes you have to come back and hit reset. We're going through a reset. So we've cut back on the number of cities we operate in from 19 to 8 in the last couple of months. Cincinnati still being the biggest market that we operate in and a very important market for us. But that's not a sign that we're not here forever and for the long term. It's a sign that we're doing the right thing for our customer. What we found was our experience that our customer was having was not consistent across all of our cities, and it wasn't consistent every time they had a transaction with us because we grew too quickly.
What do you think happens in a situation like yours where a company has expanded out, in this case geographically, to 19 markets? Now you've cut back. What happens in those markets that you're pulling back from, and what's going to be necessary and able to get started in those markets again?
So the markets that we pulled back from are all exciting markets for the long term for us. New York City is one of them. LA is one of them. So these are probably $100 million businesses for us in each of those cities alone. So those are hard choices to back out. But what it means is we'll learn a lot more about how to scale in the 8 cities we currently are in before we enter back into those cities with a much bigger operation next time, and be able to deliver the consistent experience that our customer is looking for.
And for the when you say the customer, is that the customer who is calling and saying, I want things, I want to get sold through your company, or was it the customers who were buying through your company?
It's actually both. It's a great question. One of the things the company did here in Willmar is they have a sort of 25,000 square foot warehouse that is an excellent pickup and drop off location for the local community when they purchase or they have something they want to sell through consignment. That wasn't replicated across very many of the other markets, and that part of the experience was a big miss outside of Cincinnati. So you'll see us do that in all of the 7 other markets we're currently operating in. We're opening a facility that's very similar to what we have here in Willmar. So that's on the seller side. On the buyer side, shipping costs became too high because everything was being centralized out to Blue Ash. And so our shipping costs got very high for buyers that were far away from Blue Ash, Ohio, and they didn't have a pickup option. So we're going to fix that by having either local pickup and drop-off, or the things that we ship from Blue Ash will be smaller items. Think jewelry, gems, collectibles, artwork, those kinds of things, coins that are pretty easy to ship and will have low costs. Those will come into a central facility in Blue Ash, and we'll continue to grow employment there in time. But for now, we're decentralizing our large items back out into the cities they come from.
So that means more space you're going to have to rent out in those other cities. So that's investment you have to make and people to manage those.
And that's exactly where our investment dollars are going right now, is people in the local markets and also retooling out at Blue Ash to be prepared, particularly in the jewelry and gem space and smaller items, to have a high-volume, low-cost production facility out there. We happen to be in a skew of one business where everything we sell is unique and we only have one of them. That's a complicated supply chain to manage. And luckily, we're here in southern Ohio and northern Kentucky, where probably one of the best places in the country for supply chain, logistics, warehouse and software around that. So that is really helpful, that expertise and talent that's here in the local area that's going to help us really understand our supply chain challenge. I think will actually help us create a significant competitive moat long term.
Yeah, it's one of those other areas in the talent side, the importance of logistics here in our area that I think a lot of people miss because, you know, what is it? It's a new terminology. It's whatever. Mm-hmm. Tony, as you hear this, Everything But the House is comparatively a pretty large established company.
Yeah.
At the Brandery, talk a little bit about what you do and what stage are most of the companies that you're working with.
Yeah, absolutely. And just actually, it was very recent, but I've just in the past 30 days have shifted out of the direct day-to-day role. So Jeff, I want to give Jeff Bay, who's now the new general manager of the Brandery, a little credit, not coming in here trying to step on him. But yeah, I'm still involved with the Brandery, and we're kind of setting up some new things that we're going to be announcing through our Main Street Ventures brand over the next couple months. But yeah, to your point, the companies that are coming through the Brandery have very different issues than what EBTH went through. We hope that the companies that come through that we're supporting get to the point where they are at a scale where they are. We hope they don't have to go through a rough patch like EBTH is going through. But our goal is to get them to scale up. And, you know, we're usually dealing with companies that are two or three people, not necessarily just an idea. They have to have a product in market, maybe a little bit of traction, which could be a certain number of users, a certain number of amount of revenue. And our goal is to get them to that first round of funding. So I think EBTH is on their fourth round of funding, and each round gets bigger and bigger, and there's more and more pressure that comes along with that round, each round, to execute on that. But we're trying to get these companies of two or three people, call it $600,000 to $1 million for what's called their seed round of financing, so they can come up with a plan and go out and execute it. But very rarely do you hear about a startup finding great success that is executing on the plan that they had when they were two or three people. You know, the best startups, we always say we invest in people. When people apply to the Brandery, we're looking at the level of the entrepreneur, not necessarily the level of the idea. That's a very small part of it, because we know there's going to be all sorts of twists and turns. You know, a great example is Ahology, which now has, I'm not sure how many employees, but they're doing very well out in Mount Lookout. That started as an app on your phone where you could take pictures of receipts, and it would collate that data and give you suggestions and deals and stuff. And then went through two or three different business ideas. But Michael Warschlager, the original founder of Ahology, we just knew that this guy was a great entrepreneur. He was going to figure it out. So, you know, I've hoped that the team at EBTH, you know, there's ebbs and flows and turns. And, you know, I hope they have the team in place that can figure that out.
Before we take a break, Dan, I want to go back to you, because two things have been talked about here. One is various rounds of funding. And to use your original analysis, I think it's safe to say we're in a lot better shape than we were a decade ago on venture capital availability in Cincinnati. And then secondly, though, there's talk about availability of the talent that is available at different stages for different companies. So you want to comment on those two things specifically?
Well, in terms of venture capital funding, last summer I got some data from PitchBook, which gave me like a quarterly analysis. They track all the deals in the country, and they break it. They can break it down by industry, by geography. And in the quarter that I received the data for, Cincinnati was not in the top 50 in terms of deal flow and the amount of venture capital investment placed here. And then if you look at it over time, we had a big jump in between 2012 and 13, where it went from about 20 million to 80 million. And then it has kind of plateaued. It's stayed there for the last 3 to 5 years. And I know I've talked to folks at Cincy Tech, and Mike Venerable has kind of pushed back on this idea. He thinks, you know, among the universe of companies that they're investing in, that there continue to be gains every year. He said, we see more venture capital every year. We see new players from outside the region every year. But if you just look at the numbers on a sort of a static basis for Cincinnati, it hasn't really gone much above 80 million a year for 5 years now.
Okay. I can add one quick thought to that.
Sure.
If we have a sec. The thing that really, I just, you know, I've been in Boston a lot and just spent 3.5 years in executive in residence at a venture capital firm in Boston called General Catalyst Partners. And the one thing that really moves that needle regionally is our growth rounds. If you continue to raise Series A after Series A after Series A, and those companies don't get to Series B and Series C and bigger, that's when the numbers really start to balloon, because a Series A is probably 5 to 10 million. A Series C might be 50 million plus. So that's what's really going to push those numbers. So as Cincinnati sees more maturing companies that look more like the size of EBTH today, those numbers should trend up. But you got to get across to the other side of the growth stage.
Let's pick up on this question of second, third rounds of funding and why maybe they're missing in this market, and what that may indicate. So, Scott, you were about to say something, I think.
Well, it was just sort of following the thought, I guess, I was on. What makes the numbers regionally get much bigger when you just total up all the venture capital in a year or over some period of time is our growth stage rounds, because those can be 50 to 100 million at a pop versus 5 or 10 for a Series A round. And the more companies in Cincinnati or in any city that are funded at the growth stage, you're just going to see the numbers total in the region balloon. As that happens. And there's two reasons that might not be happening. One is the companies aren't getting big enough and are failing or don't need more capital, or they're getting sold before they get to that stage. And I don't know the data here well enough, but one of those two things may be happening if you're plateauing right now.
Tony, what do you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, it is, I don't want to call it a problem, but it is something we see, especially in a Midwest ecosystem that's not necessarily mature, is I have personal friends where, you know, their startups have gotten to the point where, you know, they could, if they exited, you know, in order to become a billion-dollar company, you got to turn down an acquisition offer at $50 million, $100 million, $250, $500. And when you own 10% of the company and somebody offers you $50 million and you've never, you know, that's $5 million in your pocket, that's life-changing money. So I think for a lot of startup ecosystems—
And that can be a chance to go out and do it again.
Correct, yeah, but that takes time. So, right. You know, I have friends right now that have sold their first company, did very well. Now they're doing another company, and now they're not going to sell for 50. They're going to, you know, hold out for that $100, $200 million. So, you know, when you talk about Boston, New York, and San Francisco and the Valley, you have just such a pool of people that have already made their first, they've already had their first home run, and now they can kind of take a little bit more risk knowing that they have that fire stop, that, you know, they have money in the bank.
I think the other question is, on the talent side, mm-hmm. do we have enough talent here to get people to those next stages? Or are funders saying to companies, and I've seen this happen, where if you want that next round of investment, you're going to have to move to Boston or to Austin or to Seattle. And consequently, that money may be invested in those companies, but they're not in Cincinnati anymore.
Well, I mean, I think every company is a little bit different. I mean, I'll be frank. When I thought about taking the CEO job, you know, I was sitting in Harvard Square in Boston in a venture capital firm and thinking about moving to Cincinnati to take this role. And one of the first questions I asked myself on the board is, can you build a big growth stage company in Cincinnati? And when you step back and look at what it takes to build EBTH to be a big company, it's probably three things. It's brand. There's plenty of that around here with CPG and all the CPG consulting firms and agencies. I talked earlier about reverse logistics and supply chain. There's a ton of that around here. You probably can't find a better place in the United States for that talent. The third is data and tech. That's where I have some questions in Cincinnati. So we're working hard to figure out, like, how do we recruit people in? Is that working with the universities? We'd hate to have to do it, but if we had to, we'd build an outpost somewhere else where that talent exists. We're going to try not to do that because we're committed. We're staying here in Cincinnati. But every company that gets to growth stage has to go through that. We just recruited a local Cincinnatian back. Adam Weber left Cincinnati to go to New York and then L.A., and was in L.A. and went from Series A through exit at Dollar Shave Club when it was sold to Unilever. He's an ex-P&G, local West Side guy, wanted to come back with his wife and his family. He's back, and he's our CMO. So it's quite possible to recruit great talent back here. So if it's not here now, we're finding success in bringing the talent back.
Dan, oh, sorry.
In the case of Cincinnati, where are we strong? Where do we have the – You can't. We're not mature enough. We're not big enough to have the talent across all spectrums.
Yeah.
Where do you think we have the talent for startup?
Branding, and logistics is another category. I'm thinking of Dotloop, for example, the real estate company that when it got new investors, a lot of what it needed was increased technology. And they solved that problem by having a twin headquarters here and then in San Francisco. Ultimately, they were sold to Zillow. And the same goes for AssureX Health, which was another promising startup that was acquired, and largely because there was out-of-town money and talent that liked its products and, you know, wanted to acquire it. So, you know, both of those companies still have employees in Cincinnati, but it's not the same as being, a headquartered company that's based here and shows other startups the way.
But look, other cities have had the same challenge. I'm born and raised in Pittsburgh, went to CMU. CMU with the city of Pittsburgh recruited Google to come in next door to the campus. If you go there now, the whole Uber initiative around automated vehicles for Uber was built out of that same group of people. So policymakers and universities can get together and recruit large companies in to bring talent pools or keep talent pools locally. So I've seen it happen in other cities. And, you know, maybe that's one of the missing pieces still left in Cincinnati to fill in.
I do think one of the smartest things Centrifuge did was get big companies like Kroger and P&G involved in the ecosystem? Because maybe, Tony, you can speak to that. How much talent or how much do those startups learn by having access to some of the world's best branding? Brains.
Yeah, and the Brandery has a long relationship with Procter & Gamble as well. We had a fellowship program that put companies in our cohort on a direct path to a paid pilot, you know, something that usually it would take a year or two to get through the red tape and bureaucracy to get to an actual paid pilot with a brand. It kind of shortcut that for us. But yeah, you know, getting the big co's in Cincinnati involved in the startup ecosystem is good. Not necessarily, at least I would say, not necessarily from a talent perspective. The best thing about it is more than anything, even more than talent, because when I deal with these companies, they're small. If you don't have the talent in the first two or three person team, you know, you're not really looking elsewhere. It's we need these big companies to be customers of these startups. You know, you made a really good point about Adam coming back here. You know, I'd add a fourth bucket to that. The type of talent that we need here that we're missing, and that is people that have gone through the ride to scale. You know, the one thing I think we're missing in this ecosystem is that supernova exit that mints 20 millionaires overnight that understand angel investing and startups. They want to either go out and start something new, or they want to use their newfound wealth to invest in other companies. When you know, something like a Groupon or an Angie's List in Indianapolis. I think that once we have that, that is kind of, I think, what starts the fusion in Startup Cincy. And now we're kind of a self-maintaining mechanism that can go. But I think, you know, I think we're about 10 to 12 years into a 20-year process to really build out a true startup ecosystem. And yeah, hopefully more people that have been through that journey come back to town, because it really is, it's a different company. The type of person you need to run a two or three person company is different than the type of person you need to run a 100-person or a 500-person company. Some very rare unicorns have the skill set to do both, but it's very rare to find somebody that can do that. So we need more of those people that have seen that growth happen.
Well, I would suggest that in places that maybe have more developed, more mature ecosystems, startup ecosystems, that the idea of companies starting, selling, people moving on, getting to a certain stage and deciding that's it and I'm going to sell out and move up, that's accepted. Here, I think maybe one of my reactions to your article, yeah, Dan, was maybe we're wringing our hands too much because a few companies have decided to do just that. And, oh my gosh, why aren't they still headquartered in Cincinnati? That's part of this startup mentality, I think. And I don't think anybody in Silicon Valley or Boston or Seattle would worry about that, because there's so many companies out there doing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that kind of answers the question, doesn't it? There aren't that many here, so we need every one of them we can get.
Well, I think Tony made a good point earlier. If you get to be a $100 million or $1 billion company, you're probably going to turn down a couple offers on the path to get there. I built Zipcar over 10 years in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We must have turned down half a dozen offers and decided to go public eventually, and then we sold to Avis after we were a public company. So we ended up doing both in the end. But, you know, and it's those are really hard choices. I happen to think in EBTH's case that we're probably more likely a net buyer because we're a cross-category marketplace, one of the few that's come along in quite a while.
What do you mean by that?
Cross-category meaning we have billions of dollars of potential market out there that goes across everything from sports memorabilia to watches to art to jewelry to gems to home decor. So we could be a buyer of verticals that are doing just those bits in the long term and wrap that into EBTH. So I see us as maybe a consolidator someday. And, you know, we're trying to build the EBTH brand around the idea that it's everything but the house, that it's you know, in that cross-category strategy, it could end up being organic. It could end up being M&A driven.
And because you're online, are you, in effect, a threat to the entire auction industry as it's traditionally been conceptualized?
I think so. I think we're disintermediating low-tech and no-tech, local-to-local marketplaces that are called auction houses, essentially. And that's really exciting because that alone is probably a $50 billion business. So anything between what OfferUp can put out and what Sotheby's can do, I think that's EBTH is white space. So $100 to maybe $15,000 of item value, that's our fair game. That's a $50 billion market in the United States.
We did have a call that came in, and I didn't clarify this at the time. Somebody called in and asked how many people were laid off from everything but the house, and how many people do you employ now, and what are your projections, say, in some reasonable amount of time? I don't know how you're laid out at this point in terms of strategic planning.
So in terms of just the numbers, we went from 19 markets to 8 markets. And as we did that, a lot of items that were coming to Blue Ash either went away or are going to be staying locally in the 8 markets that remain. So between the 11 markets we closed down and fewer workers needed in Blue Ash to process items we were sending here, in total, we reduced the workforce from about 900 to about 450. It's about 950 to 475, something like that. So almost in half. About 2.5 months ago now. I think as we grow, we'll see that number return to 1,000 and beyond relatively quickly, like in the next couple of years, because our marketplace is the potential for the marketplace is substantial. We've got to grow back into that with new markets and new activity. The other thing that could make that grow is an acquisition, and I've repeated that a couple of times now.
Right.
So we're looking hard, frankly.
That's a hint, I think.
Well, it could be, but not that it's too soon right now. But I think if your strategy is be the biggest marketplace for authenticated used secondhand goods, that's our strategy, then there's lots of room for us to buy companies to do that on the supply side.
Well, I want to thank Scott Griffith of Everything But the House, Tony Alexander, who's with The Brandery, and Dan Monk with WCPO.com for being with us today to talk about startups and the ecosystem that is still maturing in Cincinnati, and we have every reason to keep pushing it as far as we can. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.